From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the new AIDS drugs. They may be changing AIDS from a terminal illness to a chronic disease. We talk with Dr. Marcus Conant, who has participated in test trials of these new drugs. He runs one of the largest AIDS medical practices in the country and has been treating people with AIDS since the early days of the epidemic. He'll tell us how the new drugs are changing the picture for doctors and patients. And David Bianculli looks at TV coverage of the Olympics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Commerce Department reports the nation's economy expanded at a rapid pace of 4.2% in the second quarter of this year. President Clinton assembled a quick news conference today, calling the report good news for America.
4 years ago today, the economy was drifting, unemployment was nearly 8%, job growth was weak, the deficit was at an all-time high. Great American industries were falling behind. For the last 3 years, we have had in place a comprehensive plan to put our economic house in order and to create opportunity for the American people.
But many analysts think the economy will slow down during the second half of this year. A member survey of the National Association of Purchasing Management indicates that industrial activity moderated in July. The Senate takes up the welfare reform bill today. It easily passed the House yesterday just after President Clinton said he would sign it, even though it's flawed, he said. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Majority Leader Trent Lott calls the president's decision to sign the bill good news, and House Republicans jubilantly began the process of taking credit for welfare reform and denying credit to the president. House Majority Leader Dick Armey said he was astounded by the president's claim that the bill was the result of his efforts.
I have to tell you, I saw that speech. I didn't believe it. I don't believe it. This is a Republican victory.
President Clinton says he knows some Republicans will try to make that case, but he says they'll have a hard time because he championed welfare reform long before it became a hot political issue when he was the governor of Arkansas. Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle says he won't vote for this bill, but he's glad the president recognizes it will need to be fixed next year. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
Thousands of Palestinians today protested the death of a Palestinian prisoner who was allegedly tortured by Yasser Arafat's security forces. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The West Bank city of Nablus was shut down today by a general strike, the first time this was directed against the Palestinian Authority instead of against Israel. 26-year-old Mahmoud Jamail died in an Israeli hospital last night from a fractured skull and with burns on his body, both apparently suffered while in Palestinian custody. Thousands of Palestinians protested today, shouting slogans against PLO President Yasser Arafat. Arafat ordered an inquiry into the death, but Palestinian human rights workers say findings of inquiries into the deaths of six other Palestinians who died while in Palestinian custody were never published. Palestinian analysts say there's increasing frustration with Arafat's autocratic rule and worry it could turn violent. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 26.5 points at 5,554. The Nasdaq is up 8.5 points at 1,089. This is NPR. Legislation intended to make sure the nation's drinking water stays safe is expected to pass the House and Senate today. The bill creates a $7.6 billion revolving fund over 7 years that upgrades municipal and rural water systems. The bill's likely to be the only major environmental measure to come out of the current Congress, which is dominated by conservative Republicans opposed to many extensions of federal power. The bill would give smaller communities greater flexibility in meeting federal standards, but it requires all water agencies tell consumers every year what contaminants are in their tap water. An Olympic athlete from Iraq has defected to the United States. Weightlifter Raed Ahmad fled from Iraq's Olympic officials yesterday. Joshua Leves of member station WABE reports from Atlanta.
Raed Ahmed has planned to defect to the U.S. ever since he was slotted to compete in the Atlanta Olympics. The 29-year-old weightlifter from Iraq says a tyrannical government has made his country a living hell. Ahmed planned his defection with the help of the Iraqi National Congress, a government opposition group in Iraq with support in the U.S. Ahmed waited to hear that his wife had reached a safe hiding place in northern Iraq. Then yesterday, he ran from his Atlanta hotel while his team leaders were at breakfast. Ahmed officially requested asylum from the U.S. yesterday, but has not received an answer. Meanwhile, he believes his team leaders, whom he calls pawns of the government, have begun a search for him. Ahmed's defection isn't the first of the summer. Two Cuban athletes announced their intention to defect in early July. For National Public Radio, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
Taiwanese officials say Typhoon Herb blasted into China today with winds at 87 miles per hour. 14 storm-related deaths are reported in Taiwan. Officials there add 4 people are missing and 200 people have been hurt. So far, there are no reports of deaths or injuries in China. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. People with AIDS have new hope as a result of new drugs. With the help of these new drugs called protease inhibitors, AIDS may be transformed from a fatal disease to a chronic illness. But these drugs are also raising new questions for doctors and patients and bringing a new set of potential problems. The results of short-term drug tests were reported at the International AIDS Conference last month in Vancouver. My guest, Dr. Marcus Conant, participated in tests of protease inhibitors for over a year. He runs one of the largest AIDS medical practices in the U.S., the Conant Medical Group in San Francisco. He's treated people with AIDS since the early days of the epidemic. We asked him to describe the results he's been getting with the new protease inhibitors.
Well, I think that the clearest way to explain that, Terry, is to compare the protease inhibitors, which are this whole new group of drugs, to some of the drugs that we've had now for almost a decade. AZT was released in 1987, so that's almost 10 years ago. And if you put a patient on AZT alone, you can reduce the amount of virus in their blood by a half a log. So if they have a viral load of a million, you can drop it down a half a log from that level. A log is a factor of 10. If you put them on a couple of drugs like AZT, you might get it down to a log or even a log and a half drop. But unfortunately, if there's any virus left, and that virus is replicating very rapidly, sometimes within a matter of a week or two, sometimes in the matter of a year, the patient will become resistant to the drugs that you're using. With the protease inhibitors, we are able to reduce the viral load by 2 logs. And so you get a dramatic drop in the viral load. And when you combine the protease inhibitors with the drugs like AZT that we've had now for almost 10 years, in many patients, often in most patients, you see the viral load go down to below the levels where we can detect virus in their blood.
Now, what are the implications for life expectancy?
Well, we don't know. I mean, clearly all of this data is less than a year old, but it is the virus that causes the disease. There's no question about that. And people like Dr. Duesberg and others who for years have said, well, it's not the virus. This virus is nothing more than a fellow traveler. That's clearly been disproved by the data that's come out in the last year. It is the virus. And if you can eliminate that virus, if you can make it go away, then the patient should have a normal life expectancy. Now, there are a number of problems, and we'll talk about those, in trying to achieve that. But the ideal would be giving patients drugs they can take in combinations they can take, making that viral load go to zero, and keeping it there for the life of the patient.
Can you maybe tell us about one patient who's responded well to this new treatment?
Sure. I'll tell you a patient that I saw this morning because it makes 2 points simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
This is a patient and a friend, someone I've known for years, who did very, very well with his infection, watched his first lover die of the disease. Even though he was infected, he was doing very well, working out at the gym, a man in his mid-30s. And suddenly, when his CD4 count, his helper T cell count, got down to about 10 or 12, he developed a few lesions of Kaposi sarcoma. And he started getting more lesions of Kaposi sarcoma. And when we measured his viral load, when we measured the amount of virus in his blood, it was higher than 200,000 viral particles per cc of blood. We put him on the combination therapy that we're talking about, ritonavir, which is the Abbott protease inhibitor, AZT, which is a drug that Glaxo Welcome has had out for a long time, and 3TC, which is another Glaxo Welcome drug. And on those three drugs, his viral load went all the way down to zero.
Wow.
There was no measurable virus in this man's blood. The astounding thing, and I have submitted this for publication, is his Kaposi sarcoma then not only stopped, it didn't just arrest it, it slowly went away. And we have now seen more than a dozen patients where this has happened, and other investigators are reporting this at meetings.
And Kaposi is an opportunistic cancer that a lot of people with AIDS get.
Precisely. And this opportunistic cancer goes away not because you're treating the cancer, but because you're eliminating the virus that causes the AIDS infection. This man experienced was essentially clear of any Kaposi sarcoma, and his viral load stayed essentially zero for the year from May of 95, when he went on these drugs, until May of 96, just a few weeks ago. Because the ritonavir upset his stomach so much, he stopped the medicine. And within weeks, he started getting new lesions of Kaposi sarcoma. And when we measured his viral load, it had gone back up to something over 100,000. We restarted the medication. His viral load now is back down to undetectable, and his Kaposi sarcoma is going away again.
How are you dealing with the side effects?
Well, the side effects, of course, are one of the major problems. I mean, all these drugs raise incredible hopes. And so scientifically, what's happened is a major breakthrough. I think that it also focuses us on how we as a society are really failing our people in terms of being able to provide medications for them, because these drugs are very costly, and it's extremely difficult for people to take them in a way where they're really going to get optimal benefit, where they will not develop resistance. Let me just give you a scenario. Let's assume that I had a patient that I want to put on combination therapy, and I put them on Crixivan, which is Endenavir, which is the Merck protease inhibitor, and I put them on DDI, which is a reverse transcriptase inhibitor, and say 3TC. How would they take those drugs? Well, the 3TC is taken twice a day with meals. So you take one in the morning with breakfast and one in the evening with dinner. That's easy. The DDI must be taken an hour before or an hour after you eat. So sometime between breakfast and lunch and sometime between dinner and bedtime, you must take your dose of DDI. It's taken twice a day. The Crixivan has to be taken three times a day on an empty stomach and not at the same time that you take the DDI. And so the patient has to take something with breakfast, something an hour later, something an hour later, have some lunch, take a drug in the middle of the afternoon, have dinner with another pill, take another pill an hour later, and take something at bedtime. Now, think about it. For most people, that's almost an impossible regime to achieve.
And you need to be very diligent and basically carry an alarm with you to always remind you what your next pill is.
That's correct. And it's even worse than that. You see, you know, with many drugs, we tend to over-medicate. We mm-hmm. give patients more than they need to treat the condition just because we know that people can't be compliant. But if you stop these drugs for as short a period of time as 2 to 3 days, certainly if you stop them for a week, the virus comes right back and the viral load goes right back up. Now, there's some good data, and we'll discuss this in a moment, showing that if you can get that viral load to zero in the blood, as we've discussed, there is no resistance. In other words, if you can cut the virus off, the virus does not become resistant to these drugs. But if you stop the drugs and the virus comes back, it is during that rapid expansion and billions of virus particles being produced that the resistant mutants arise, and that's when the patient then becomes resistant to the drug. So not only is this a hassle, and not only is it expensive, but the real downside is if the patient doesn't do it or can't do it, or the pharmacy's closed for a 3-day weekend and he forgot to refill his medication, he may now become resistant to the drug and it may not work.
Now, could that breed a more resistant AIDS virus that other people could contract?
That's a great question. Transmission of protease-resistant virus has not yet been described, but there are many of us given other diseases that we have seen and that we know of where we fear that that's exactly what will happen. Look at tuberculosis as the paradigm. We have come up with drugs almost 50 years ago that are very effective in terms of treating tuberculosis. The problems are the same now that we have with AIDS. First, you've got to find people who are infected. So we've got to find out if people are infected so we can get them on the correct drug. And then we have to be certain that they take the drugs and that they take them appropriately. Because if they don't, the tuberculous bacillus becomes resistant to the drug, and then the patient has multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. And when that happens, you have no drug that you can treat the patient with, and if the patient coughs on, say, a loved one or a healthcare provider or just someone on the bus, that person will transmit multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, and then you will have nothing to treat the new patient with as well. There have been cases in California and in New York of healthcare workers within the last 10 years dying of multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis that they acquired from someone who didn't take their medicine.
Are there patients who you're afraid to prescribe this new combination therapy because you think that they won't be diligent in taking their medicine and that they might breed a resistant version of the AIDS virus?
My colleagues and I have discussed that. Fear probably is not the correct word, but I think that some prudence should be shown, and this should be a subject that society, that an informed society should really discuss. For example, if you have a patient who can't keep his or her appointments, you know, every time you give him an appointment to be seen, not only do they not show up, they don't even call and say they're not coming. Or you have a history of you've prescribed drugs and they never got the prescription refilled. Or you know they're not taking certain drugs because often we can tell if they're taking a drug or not because of changes in their blood work. And so you have a patient that you know is not compliant. Now, is it in the patient's interest to give them a drug to which they are going to become resistant? Or should you wait until that person does become really committed to taking the medication so that we are certain that we're going to get maximal benefit? And is it in the interest of society to treat someone with a drug when we know they're going to misuse it and develop resistance? And finally, should society pay for the drug, which it does in many cases, for someone where you know that the ultimate outcome is going to be not only it's not going to work, but it may lead to resistance? Now, I think those are subjects that are worthy of discussion.
How have you had to deal with them in your own practice?
Well, I'm truly blessed. As you know from some of our previous discussions, my colleagues and I have probably the largest HIV practice, and certainly in San Francisco, and one of the largest in the countries. But our population is made up almost exclusively of well-educated gay men, most of whom are very well-motivated. And so we have the very, very fortunate situation of having, if you will, a practice where patients really do come because they want to get better. Most of them are very compliant. Even those that we know are using recreational drugs tend to still get up and go to work in the morning. And so we've not had to wrestle with this as a problem. But there are clinics where that is a real problem and where we do expect to see the emergence of resistance. Let me say, too, in this regard, we have seen the emergence of resistance even in people who have been compliant and taken all of the drugs as prescribed. So I don't want to leave you with the misconception that all you need to do is take the drugs and this is going to work 100% of the time in every patient.
My guest is Dr. Marcus Conant. He runs one of the largest AIDS medical practices in the U.S., the Conant Medical Group in San Francisco. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Marcus Conant. He's the medical director of the Conant Medical Group in San Francisco, and they have a very large AIDS practice. Tell us how the protease inhibitors work. These are the new AIDS drugs.
That's right. And they work at a different stage than the drugs that people have heard of before. The first drugs that we had, things like AZT, worked by blocking the step that the virus needs to take. When it enters the cell, the virus is an RNA virus, and it must become DNA so that it can enter your cell and stay as part of your cell for the rest of your life or the life of that cell. And to do that, it has to reverse itself. The RNA must become DNA. And so there's a step called reverse transcriptase that makes that happen. And if you have a reverse transcriptase inhibitor, which is what AZT is, you block that step. Now, when the virus goes to replicate and make the next generation of virus, it comes out of the DNA of your cell, and it starts producing protein, which we call a protease. And or the protease is the thing that dissects this protein that comes out of the cell's nucleus, if you will. Think of it very much like a kite cord. If you're standing there putting a kite up in the sky and you're letting this cord come out, there's just pieces of cord going on and on and on and on and on, and that's the way that proteins come out of the nucleus of the cell. What you need to make insulin or to make testosterone or to make any hormone in the body, and what the virus needs to make up the next generation of virus, is to cut that cord in very precise lengths and even stack it up very much like cord would. So you want to go from a step where you have a continuous cord going out to a step where you've got it cut in very nice little boxes, and those are stacked up like cordwood, each one cut exactly the same length. The thing that cuts it is a protease. And so the protease cuts this protein strand into exactly the right lengths. And the protease that the virus brings with it to do its cutting is different from any protease that you or I have in our body. And so if you could inhibit that protease, if you could poison that one step, those scissors that are cutting that cord, then you could prevent the virus from cutting out the part of that protein strand that it needs to make the next generation. And you not only prevent viral replication, but you kill that cell because all of this stuff just kind of wraps up like a ball of twine in the cytoplasm of the cell. And so the drugs are called protease inhibitors, because they are inhibiting the enzyme which cuts that cord. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, these new protease inhibitors are being used in conjunction with other drugs. So the kind of therapy you're using now isn't just one drug. It's two or three drugs at a time. What's the advantage of this combination therapy?
Well, if you take a wild strain virus, a virus that's not seen any of these drugs before, and you give them just one of the drugs, the problem is that you don't completely cut off viral replication. And so then a virus mutates, and that mutation then makes it resistant to the drug that you're using. So let's say that you give a patient just a protease inhibitor, and you reduce the viral load from 1 million copies of virus down to only 1,000 copies. That's a tremendous advance. But that 1,000 viral particles keep replicating, and before long, one of them emerges that has evolved and is now resistant to the drug. At that point, that one is now no longer killed by the drug and then starts expanding very rapidly and infecting the patient with this now resistant virus. If you add a second drug, say you add AZT to the protease inhibitor, now then you reduce the viral load even further. There's less virus to replicate and become resistant. And for a virus to become resistant, it now needs two mutations because it has to become resistant to the protease and to the AZT. You add a third drug and you make the challenge even harder for the virus. You add a fourth drug and you make it even harder. And what you're doing is you're making it so difficult for that virus to have enough mutations to survive that it and all the cells infected with it are dead, leaving the patient essentially free of viral load.
Now, you've referred to viral load a lot, which is the measure of the amount of the AIDS virus in somebody's blood. Is this a fairly new measurement? I know people always talked about T-cell counts, which was a measure of how somebody's immune system was doing. Is the viral load a fairly new test?
It's new, and it's entirely different, and it's extremely important for the public and for physicians and patients to understand how important this difference is. It is the virus that causes the disease, and people who have a lot of virus are going to advance very quickly, and people who don't have much virus at all are going to progress very slowly. And John Mellors, in some elegant papers, that some of which have already been published and others were presented in Vancouver, have clearly shown that if you take someone who has a very high viral load, they progress rapidly. If you take someone who has a very low viral load, they progress very, very slowly. There are two analogies that I think clearly make the point. The viral load tells you where you're going. The CD4 count, the helper T cell count, tells you where you've been. The lower the CD4 count is, the more damage that's been done to the patient's immune system and the further along they are in the course of their disease. That's where you've been. Now, if you've got a low CD4 count and a low viral load, you're still advanced, but you're moving very slowly. If you have a low CD4 count and a high viral load, you're moving very rapidly. At the International AIDS meeting in Vancouver, there was a beautiful analogy shown of a train moving toward a precipice. And if you were a passenger on that train, you would want to know, when is this thing going to go off this precipice? Well, the two things you want to know is, how far from the edge are you right now, and how fast is the train going? You could be right at the edge, and if the train's not moving, there's no risk to you. Or you could be miles away from the edge and the train's going very rapidly and you're in great trouble. Well, how far you are from the precipice is your CD4 count, and how fast the train is going is your viral load.
Dr. Marcus Conant directs the Conant Medical Group in San Francisco, one of the largest AIDS medical practices in the U.S. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how the new AIDS drugs are changing the approach of doctors and changing the lives of people with AIDS. We continue our talk with Dr. Marcus Conant. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at coverage of the Olympics. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Marcus Conant. He runs one of the largest AIDS medical practices in the U.S., and he's treated people with AIDS since the early days of the epidemic. His practice and the lives of his patients have been changed by the new class of drugs called protease inhibitors. These new drugs may be changing AIDS from a terminal illness to a chronic disease. They're prescribed in combination. Typically, a patient takes a combination of three different drugs. Who are you prescribing this new combination therapy for? Do you prescribe it to everybody who has AIDS who comes to see you?
My practice is to do essentially that, though I hasten to add that many of my colleagues who are also AIDS experts and very knowledgeable in the field don't do that. So there is, at this point, still not a consensus as to how we should approach patients. But as I have done for the 16 years I've been involved with this, Terry, I do for my patients what I would do for myself, because that's the easiest yardstick for me to use. If I were infected with the AIDS virus, I would measure my viral load. And if it was undetectable, if I could not measure any virus in my bloodstream, telling me that my own immune system was doing a pretty good job suppressing this virus, I would probably repeat that test every 4 months, and I would not go on drugs. And the reason for that is, one, I wouldn't know how well the drugs are working because I don't have anything to measure. And two, there are some other new drugs coming down the pipeline, some as soon as next February or so, that look like they're going to be even more effective, may not be as toxic to take. You may be able to take them in combination and avoid some of the problems that we're seeing right now with combination. So if I had infection and undetectable viral load, I would probably just repeat the viral load every 4 months, monitor that, and decide to go on therapy when my viral load went up. If my viral load was detectable, then I would put myself on triple combination therapy. Now, I might not choose to use a protease inhibitor, because there were some studies in Vancouver that clearly showed that if you used drugs like dilavudine, which is a new non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor, that you could get the viral load to zero. So I might decide to put myself on three reverse transcriptase inhibitors, three drugs like AZT, and save the protease inhibitor for later if, in fact, the virus became resistant. Or I might choose to use a protease with two reverse transcriptase inhibitors.
What are you telling your patients now when you put them on combination therapy? I mean, it's such an exciting time. It looks like this is a real breakthrough. But there really isn't information on the long-term results because these drugs haven't existed for that long. So on the one hand, I could see your patients being just, like, really hopeful and excited. But, you know, on the other hand, we just don't know that much yet. So what do you tell them about what to expect?
Well, here in San Francisco, we're lucky because our patient base is exceedingly knowledgeable. They often are telling us rather than we're telling them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what patients have to face is, one, you must be compliant. You have to take the drugs exactly as prescribed. Number two is there are tremendous drug-drug interactions. For example, ritonavir, which is the Abbott drug, is a very, very good protease inhibitor. But it absolutely cuts off an enzyme system in the liver called the cytochrome P450 system. It cuts it off. I had a patient recently call me and say, Mark, I took a Valium 3 days ago, and I feel like I'm still on Valium. And I said, you are, because you haven't metabolized that drug yet. And so there are all of these problems that patients have. What drugs can you take or not take in combination now with these very powerful drugs, some of which interfere with the metabolism of other drugs. But what we also are telling patients is all we know is we've cut off viral replication in the blood, because that's all the tests tell us. Whether we've cut off viral replication or viral spread in the lymph node, we do not know. Whether there is some other sequestration, some other compartment in the body where this virus can hide out, and where it's replicating, say in the brain or say in supportive cells in the brain. We do not know that. And so we only know that we can make the viral load in the bloodstream go to zero. But we know a little bit more about that fact. There's a drug called 3TC. And if you treat a patient with 3TC and they have viral replication, most patients show resistance to that drug within 2 weeks. There's a mutation at a certain position that confers resistance to 3TC, and you see that within 2 weeks. in some patients that have been treated now for more than 6 months and have had viral loads of zero in their bloodstream for more than 6 months, when you look for 3TC resistance, they don't have it. And what that means is that as far as we can tell, there is no place in their body where this virus is replicating and the virus is becoming resistant to 3TC. That's an exciting piece of information. These are the things we're telling patients, but your question is to what are the long-term side effects? What are the long-term benefits? Will this mean that if we treat people for 2 or 3 years and we completely eliminate all the infected cells, are they cured? We don't know.
So what are the realistic expectations to bring?
Well, for the compliant patient who has the proper entitlements that allow him or her access to the drugs they need, I think that there's great hope that taking these drugs properly, the patient can look forward to an essentially normal life expectancy. Now, that doesn't mean that a teenager ought to run out and engage in risk behavior and catch AIDS because, well, they can give me a pill and make it go away. Remember, you're going to have to see a doctor once or twice a month for the rest of your life. Remember that you're going to have a pharmacy bill of $1,000 a month or so for the rest of your life. Remember that you're going to have lab tests costing hundreds of dollars every couple of months for the rest of your life. So this does not mean that AIDS is a trivial disease, but it does hold hope for the first time that we may in fact be able to keep a certain subset of patients alive for much longer than previously and perhaps for the rest of their lives. That's the hope.
What's the difference between what the new drugs can do for somebody who's already in a real advanced stage of AIDS and what it could do for somebody who just recently became symptomatic or for somebody who's HIV positive but has had no symptoms at all?
Another great question. The person who is asymptomatic or recently infected or whose own immune system has done a great job controlling the disease sometimes for years, those patients are the ones where we really expect to see the most dramatic benefit with these drugs because those patients have had low viral loads to begin with. Remember that the long-term non-progressors, if you measure their viral load, it is usually very low if it's detectable at all. So, you know, the reason they haven't progressed is that their own immune system has suppressed the virus. And so then you just augment their immune response with these drugs, and you should be able to substantially prolong their lives. But what do you do with the patient who has 15 helper T cells, who's been infected for 10 years, who's already had pneumocystis once, who's already lost 40 pounds? Are these drugs going to have any effect on his or her life? And the answer is yes. I see every day patients who a year ago I knew were going to be dead, and they are gaining weight, they are becoming active again, they look healthy again. So these drugs literally are turning around the lives of thousands of people. Now, unfortunately, in many of these patients, we have not been able to get their viral load to zero. And so this is the group of patients where we expect to see the most rapid emergence of resistance. So we're gaining time. It gives us time to look for new drugs. It gives us time to find better combinations. But the patient who is far advanced is not getting the level of benefit of the newly infected person. However, they're getting dramatic improvements.
My guest is Dr. Marcus Conant. He runs one of the largest AIDS medical practices in the U.S. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is Dr. Marcus Conant, and he runs one of the largest AIDS practices in the United States. This must be such an exciting time for you as a doctor.
Well, it is, and yet, you know, it's what we've been hoping for, but the job is not over, Terry, because AIDS started in America. Well, AIDS probably started in Africa and spread then to Paris and Belgium and got to America very fast, but the augmentation of the disease was an American phenomenon. and then spread throughout the rest of the world, as you know. The figures coming out of Vancouver were absolutely terrifying. I mean, there are already 3 million people in India infected with this virus, and there were no cases being reported in 1990. And so we're seeing an exponential increase in this disease, as everyone's been saying for the last decade, mm-hmm. worldwide, with projections of 40 million infected people by the end of the century, which is, what, 4 years away. These drugs are amazing technological breakthroughs, but no one in the developing world, in Africa, in Thailand, in India, in South China, in Laos, in the areas where this disease is spreading like wildfire, none of those people will have these drugs.
They're too expensive.
They're too expensive. I mean, we're talking $1,000 a month to treat a patient. There are villages in Africa where $1,000 a month is the healthcare budget for the entire town. And so it's almost unconscionable that we as a people are sitting here and not looking at what we can and should and do for the rest of the world. Now, should we try to produce enough of this drug to hand to people all over the world? No, we can't afford to do that. But it really is tragic that some of the proceeds from these drugs and some proceeds from our federal coffers do not go to developing an AIDS vaccine and to developing vaginal microbicides that women can use to stop the spread of this disease.
Well, what about in the United States? Have you been finding that most people with AIDS here can afford through their health insurance to go on these new AIDS drugs?
It has not yet seemed to be a problem. And I think that the reason for that is that even though our healthcare delivery system is pretty awful at times, most people, if they get plugged into a system, find ways to get access to drugs. Remember that there are only 80 practices in the United States that take care of 80% of all of the AIDS patients in America. AIDS has not become a disease where the average doctor has become, you know, enthusiastic or even interested in caring for patients. So 80 practices take care of 80% of the patients under care. And so if a patient comes into our system, into our clinic, and does not have access to drug, we probably have someone on staff that knows how to get that patient signed up for Medicaid or indigent care or some way that he or she can access medication.
How bad are the side effects?
Well, as with side effects to any medication, it varies substantially from patient to patient, and it varies depending on how well motivated the patient is. But the side effects can be substantial. The new protease inhibitors cause a lot of abdominal cramping. They cause diarrhea. They cause nausea. If you combine that with AZT, you get fatigue and additional nausea. With 3TC, you can get neurological symptoms such as neuropathy or headache. And so patients experience all of those things. Now, we as physicians try to tell them that they should anticipate these side effects, because if someone knows something's going to happen, they generally can cope with the side effect more readily than if it just starts happening. But the side effects are a major problem for many patients and actually can be so severe as to preclude some people from taking the drug.
What a horrible choice to take if the side effects are really bad, but without the drugs you're facing a sooner death.
That's right. And yet it's interesting to watch some patients. We have had people who said, for example, I won't take AZT, it makes me sick. And now are coming in and taking AZT as part of a combination regime with other drugs. And you say, you know, I thought that stuff made you sick. And they kind of smile and say, it does. But I'm willing to put up with that because the data shows that this is going to keep me alive. And so for some patients, certainly not all, the side effects are now overcome by the patient's personal commitment to go ahead and take the medication. All of us are hoping that the next generation of these drugs will be less toxic, more patient-friendly, easier to combine. And research certainly would suggest that we are moving in that direction.
Well, I have to say, you know, you were talking before about how if you start on these new drugs and you don't follow the regimen, you can start creating resistant viruses within your system, and it's possible that those resistant viruses can be transmitted to others. There are a lot of people who have AIDS who are drug addicts, and who are homeless and don't have the tools, you know, like a clock and the kind of consciousness and discipline that you need to take the drugs regularly. Are you worried about that population using drugs in inappropriate ways and creating more resistant strains of the HIV virus?
I think it's really important that we individualize every patient, and that's one of the joys of practicing medicine, is you can do that. You individualize every patient and realize that some people are going to have terrible side effects from a drug and some people don't have side effects. And in those, you may even be able to use more drug. And in the first group, you might have to use less. And the same is true with compliance. I have patients in my practice who are intravenous drug users who are very reliable, compliant patients and go to work every day. They mm-hmm. shoot speed on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, I have patients who are total sociopaths, who are drug addicts, and who are engaging in drug-abusing behavior and are not using drugs appropriately. Every time you see them, they have a different name. And so I think it becomes incumbent on the physician to individualize the care for their patients. It may not be appropriate to just put everybody willy-nilly on all these new drugs. But by the same token, the fact that someone's homeless or an IV drug user does not necessarily mean that that person is not a good candidate for this drug. I've got a patient who I know shoots drugs on the weekend and is sort of out of it for a day, who's on combination therapy and doing very, very well.
And taking the pills responsibly?
Yes. So again, I think you need to individualize
mm-hmm.
it. But by the same token, I think that that's where the problem will be seen. Remember, that's where we saw multi-drug resistant tuberculosis was in people in New York who were selling the drug to buy more street drugs, more heroin, not taking their drugs appropriately and becoming resistant to the treatment for tuberculosis.
I'm wondering if you find that you're any more or less emotionally detached or attached to your patients now that you're using these new drugs, which seem to be doing very well.
Oh, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I was emotionally attached to lots of people that we've lost over the years, and I'm emotionally attached to lots of people where I'm delighted to see that they're doing well. I think that the doctors I know who care for AIDS patients have come to grips with their emotions regarding this disease, and that we allow ourselves to become involved in our patients' lives to become very fond of our patients and not try to deal with our patients at arm's length. You learn early on, I think, that the joy you get out of this is not because you saved someone's life, because you know you can't do that, and you don't get devastated when they die. You realize that you were one of the people who could become involved in their lives. You could make their lives more comfortable, you could prolong their lives, and that's what you're getting out of it. And when the patient dies, at least you can say to yourself, I was there for him, and lots of other people in this society were not.
Have the new drugs changed your idea about how long you can continue doing an AIDS practice? I know for a lot of doctors, the burnout factor is so great, watching so many people who you come to care for die.
I think the thing that's going to substantially change the practice of medicine, AIDS medicine, is probably not burnout. It's probably going to be managed care. So I think that it's not going to be an emotional, it's going to be an economic issue. Many physicians who are my age, who've been doing this for a long time, have learned that one of the ways that you control the burnout is that you get good, bright, young nurse practitioners and physician assistants and young physicians, and you put them between a large number of the patients and you. You may still have a few patients that you manage personally. You're writing the prescriptions. And then you've got a group of people between you and this huge volume of patients that you're seeing, because we're seeing 80 to 90 patients a day. And that's how you move up and remain involved, remain able to have an input in terms of patient management and yet not be handling that phone call from a devastated mother or relative every night. But the thing that's really beginning to impair our ability to practice is the managed care programs are coming in, reimbursing at a lower and lower and lower rate, and saying, well, you need to see four of these patients an hour. Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that if a man or a woman is experiencing symptoms that may suggest he or she's going blind and is throwing up every time they take this new drug, which they've got to take, and whose lover has just left him and he's suicidal and he hadn't decided whether he should tell his mom yet that he's dying of AIDS, and he walks in this morning with all those questions, you can't see him and three other patients in an hour. There is no way that can be done, and yet the economics of the system is suggesting that that's what must be done.
Dr. Conan, I wish we had more time to talk, but we're out of time. I thank you so much for sharing some of your knowledge and experience with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Marcus Conant directs the Conant Medical Group in San Francisco, one of the largest AIDS medical practices in the U.S. Coming up, TV coverage of the Olympics. This is Fresh Air. This Sunday, after broadcasting more than 100 hours of TV coverage, NBC will present the closing ceremonies of the 1996 Summer Olympics. Our TV critic, Deva Bianculli, has watched almost all of the coverage so far, and then some.
Before I start, I feel like I should tell you about my own childhood trauma and how I had to fight for years and buck some pretty strong odds just to reach this point. See, in the true spirit of NBC's Olympics coverage, I don't want you to just listen to me today. I want you to like me and root for me. And you will, I know, because I'm an American. But if you've been satisfied with NBC's Olympic coverage the last 2 weeks, what I'm about to say may sound un-American. But it's more than that. For reasons I'll get to in a minute, it's also un-Canadian. Yes, the injured Carrie Strug's final vault in the women's team gymnastics competition made for great TV. But part of the reason it made for such great TV is that NBC packaged and presented the surprise American victory hours after it happened. NBC knew just what it had and just how to edit it to give it the most impact. NBC has manipulated time all through these Olympics and been very dishonest about labeling it as such. The network calls that coverage plausibly live. I call it definitely manipulative. Another thing that bugs me about NBC's coverage is its obvious disdain for the audience. It's downplaying or ignoring entire sports just to present the ones it thinks will appeal specifically to young women who don't normally watch sports. The ratings are higher as a result, so NBC can claim to have made the right move. What we'll never know, though, is if those women would have watched anyway, if NBC had chosen to present the Olympics a different way, with fewer sappy features and more true sports coverage. Nothing irritates me more, though, than the jingoism. NBC seems to think that if America isn't winning, Americans aren't interested. When the USA women's gymnastic team won the gold, we saw Carrie Strug and the other winners on the podium and heard our national anthem played as they got their medals. But two nights later, when the individual all-around competition in the same sport ended with Lilia Podkapayeva as the gold medal champion, did we see her moment of victory or hear the Ukrainian national anthem? No. And last night, would we have seen wrestling in primetime if an American hadn't been in the finals, or won, or cried? No way. The Olympic ideal, as I understand it, is a recognition and an appreciation of excellence in all athletic endeavors, regardless of national origin. That's not the way NBC is presenting it, so I decided to look elsewhere and turn my satellite dish to Canada so I could watch the Olympics coverage from Canada's CBC. I expected Canada to be more fair and less sappy. No such luck. It's just as obsessed with Canadian victories as NBC is with American ones. When Canada's Donovan Bailey won the men's 100-meter race in track and field, The CBC reran the tape of the race so many times, it looked like coverage of a marathon. Listen.
Right now, let's take one more look. Don Whitman and Steve Ovett with the call.
Linford Christie, the defending Olympic champion. So now, lane two is empty. It's Marsh, Bolden, Mitchell, Fredericks, Bailey, Essanwyn, Green. How unsettling will the three false starts be to the remaining seven runners?
In Canada, we saw Bailey get his medal, but didn't see Carl Lewis get his. In America, we saw Lewis atop the winner's platform, but not Bailey. When I was a kid, I remember listening for and enjoying all the different national anthems and getting the message that despite our national differences, the Olympics were bringing us all together. The way TV packages the Olympics today, at least on this continent, that message is almost gone. By the way, while you're listening to this, I'm at home watching more TV. For Fresh Air, this is Dave Bianculli, plausibly live.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Tracy Tannenbaum and Barbara Bogave, research assistance from Rena Bander, additional assistance from Phoebe Vanskoy. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Charles Dutton tells us how he discovered acting while in prison for manslaughter. He plays the sheriff in A Time to Kill. Also, a talk with Edward Bunker, a crime writer who hasn't yet made it to the bestseller list, but was once on the list of the FBI's 10 Most Wanted. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.